Now, from the left coast, another in-depth interview from Peter B. Collins. Peter B.'s been talking about news and politics since Watergate and generously shares his knowledge, wisdom, opinions, and outrage here because his friends and family can't take it anymore. Peter B.'s an independent progressive who upsets Democrats and Republicans as conditions require and is one of the few lefty pundits who predicted Trump would win. This podcast is funded entirely by listeners like you, and subscribers get first access to these in-depth interviews. When you're ready, go to peterbcollins.com/signup. Now, here's your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
Thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast here at peterbcollins.com. Hang on to your earbuds. Pepe Escobar returns to our show today. He's got fascinating analysis of America's hybrid warfare against China, including theories about the coronavirus. He also talks about the alliance between Russia and China, the new Silk Roads, and breaking news on the future of Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil. That's Pepe's native country. And also, Ed Lowe gets an answer to his question. This is quite a package coming your way. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you who send me subscription dollars in amounts as little as $5 a month. People like Ed Lowe, Jason Ferguson, Scott Bigelow, and Mary Vogt. Thanks to each and every one of you. This ain't no technological breakdown. Oh no, this is the road to hell. Today on the Peter B. Collins podcast, we welcome the return of globe-trotting journalist, the guy who gives us the offshore view. Brazilian-born, currently in Bangkok, Pepe Escobar joins us again today. I'm a ghost, living in a ghost town. I'm a ghost, living in a ghost town. You can look for me, but I can't be found. You can As we speak here on the 24th of April, that song is just a day from its release. Living in a ghost town, and it applies worldwide. Pepe Escobar, always great to talk to you, my friend. What's the scene in Bangkok today?
Hi, Peter. Hi, everybody. Man, this is the perfect intro. I am a ghost living in one of the many ghost towns along planet lockdown. Well, this here is amazing. Here it's as you know, this is the destination capital of the world. It's usually Paris, it's usually Bangkok, you know, their rivals. And it now it's literally a ghost town. I'm very, very worried about the real people, not the absence of tourists, not the fact that the air is better, not the fact that we can breathe the greenlands around us. But the real economy, real ties. Last week, the government, they announced a subsidy program, a monthly check of just $165 per person. You had 22 million ties that applied. Only 14 million were approved. So you have these 8 million who have absolutely nothing. No job prospects, eliminated from the economy and the informal economy because everything is still closed. And you can multiply this by a factor of infinite all across the global south, in fact. So this is the real story. You know? The virus is the story and the crisis is the virus. It's absolutely horrible.
And Pepe, let me just compare notes. I'm sure you're aware of most of this, but in the state of Florida, which has been under Republican rule for many years now, and they've dismantled the safety net programs, including the employment unemployment benefits, of some 800,000 people who have applied for a benefit of $237 a week, only 4% have received a check so far. And you know that in the huge corporate bailouts, the $2+ trillion initially, and now it's up to 2.6, but with the funny money, it's over $6 trillion, mostly pumped into banks and corporate interests. And the money that was set aside, a paltry amount for small business, was scooped up by, you know, publicly traded corporations, some of which are being shamed into returning the money. But the rich get richer, and the whole crisis capitalism movement is alive and well. The vultures are actively circling to acquire weaker companies. And, we're leaving a whole lot of people behind, including the 11 million or plus undocumented people here in the United States who don't get squat out of the borrowed money that Washington is printing and starting to distribute.
You're absolutely right, Peter. Wow, it's perfect. I think in 2 minutes, you told the whole story in the U.S. We just could add that the fact that the Fed and the Treasury turned into a huge hedge fund.
Yeah,
that's the underlining. It's practically impossible for anyone outside of the U.S. or anyone who has not lived in the U.S. for that matter to understand that. You cannot explain this all across Asia. The Europeans don't get it. But now it's a BlackRock run operation, essentially. You know, distributing helicopter money to the few ones who qualify. It's completely nuts. When I see the actual numbers of unemployed in the U.S. and people who are going to be completely eliminated from the new economy, the new digital super under control economy. Wow. It reminds me of the Global South. Most of the U.S. now is part of the struggling Global South. It's not even industrialized North anymore, right?
Well, and it kind of makes an oracle out of this young guy who ran for president, Andrew Yang, who warned us about the loss of jobs, even in the service sector here in the U.S., and has been talking about, you know, a guaranteed annual income. He had a different name for it, but that's what it is. And it's fascinating that, the oligarch Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin, said that, well, here's $1,200, and it's going to last you for 10 weeks.
For 10 weeks, exactly.
And the $1,200, in many cases, people will have to repay on their taxes next year because it's really an advance on a tax credit that not everybody will qualify for.
This is completely crazy. And correct me if I'm wrong, Peter. I was doing this calculation the other day. For an average American family, 10 weeks, they would need the equivalent of $12,000 for a family of four or five to live relatively well. He's giving a tax credit of 10% of what they need.
Right. All of the, except for the corporate money, all of the bailouts are minuscule compared to what the need is. And now we have Mitch McConnell saying that he wants to change the laws to allow states and municipalities to use the bankruptcy laws. And of course, his agenda is he wants to wipe out pension benefits, which is actually a big problem in his home state of Kentucky.
Gosh. Well, look, I cannot say that Europe is faring slightly better, because in terms of dysfunctionality, what's going on with the European Union is in a Kafka class by itself, especially after that meeting that they had, the European Council meeting yesterday, where you had the famous Frugal Four, Austria, Sweden, Denmark, and which is the other one?
Maybe
Norway? I forgot.
Norway, maybe?
No. Austria, Sweden, Denmark, and Holland. Sorry. And Holland. My Dutch ancestors. I am so ashamed of the Dutch part of my family, you know. And they are practically destroying the EU from within, which is a good thing, by the way, because there's no chance of a feasible, equanimous package delivered by Brussels to help all the EU members, especially the most vulnerable, which happen to be the Club Med countries, mm-hmm. Portugal, Spain, Greece, Italy, etc.
Yeah.
So, and I'm talking to my Italian friends a lot, and the Italexit feeling in Italy now is skyrocketing. Until virtually yesterday was something like 50% on both sides. Now it's going to definitely skyrocket to 60 or maybe 70 in the next few weeks and months. So we can say that Italexit is a very, very credible scenario for 2021, because then Italians are going to see how much more impoverished they're going to be, how much what Brussels is offering to them is a kind of a Greek-style package.
Yeah.
And people are already fed up with it. Absolutely. And you can imagine that the same feeling is spreading around France for different reasons, of course. Basically, because they hate the Macron government, mm-hmm. as well as Brussels interference and the EU. So, and when you talk to EU diplomats off the record, of course, I have some friends who we can talk as friends, not as journalists interviewing anybody. They, you know, their feeling is that, look, this thing is already, it's already collapsed. They're playing for time, but we can feel it that the whole thing is unraveling very, very fast, you know.
And Pepe, let me extend that to NATO, because
NATO, yes.
Initially, I thought Trump had some instincts there, but he converted it in just to a money squeeze and forcing the member states to pony up more for their own defense, which I find meaningless. But NATO is an organization without a mission that has been used and abused by the United States in the last 20 years. And I think it either has to be completely revamped or just dismantled.
Or just dismantle, which is and that's the problem when you try to have this conversation seriously in Brussels. Off the record, you know, most European diplomats will tell you, yes, we know that we depend on NATO. We are not independent. We cannot have our own foreign policy because everything is subordinated to NATO. NATO dictates our foreign policy. And this you can hear from, especially from the French, from the Italians as well, from the Spaniards. But the problem is Germany. And the ruling class is Germany, the Atlanticist ruling class is still very much in command, mm-hmm. you know. And their connections with the U.S. deep state especially are very, very close. So the thing is to turn Germany around, which is something that might happen post-Merkel, depending who's going to be post-Merkel. But it's terrible. And then you have those fifth columnists, the absolutely pathetic Baltic nations and Poland, you know, who are rabid anti-Russia, and they obviously need NATO badly, or Romania for that matter. But, no, otherwise the Russians are going to come here. They're going to take over the Black Sea. Okay, breaking news. Russia already controls the Black Sea. So there's nothing you can do about it. You know?
Well, and that ties into the whole Russiagate farce that led off the Trump administration and the Russophobia that is still exploited to this day. You know, Bernie Sanders was told that Russia was interfering to help him in the election, and he had to be really careful. And, you know, when we look at what divides Americans and what drives this hyper-partisanship and the incredible cult of Trump, it doesn't have anything to do with external forces, including Russia. It's all homegrown. And it smokes as bad as homegrown.
It's terrible, Peter, because when you examine what so-called intelligentsia in the U.S. is saying or writing, etc., it's still total Cold War mentality.
Yeah.
It's impossible for them to admit the rise of Russia again, the economic rise of China, the strategic partnership between Russia and China, the new Silk Roads and what they represent for over 100 nations all over the world, how China is winning the trade war everywhere, how China is the number one trade partner in the world, and it's not that they need U.S. for anything. It's only 20% of China that China exports to the U.S. They can get this 20% from the Europeans or from their neighbors in Asia later on, you know. So it's not a matter of national security for them, trading with U.S. The other day, for instance, I was trying to watch a so-called debate between Hoover Institution, Stanford types, and a guy who's writing a biography of Stalin, Stephen Kutkin, if I'm not mistaken. And it's, come on, this is it's high school stuff. Yeah. And these people pass for the creme de la creme of American intelligentsia. You know, it's mind-boggling, in fact. And obviously, we're not even talking about the Trumpist and Steve Bannonite gangs, where there's no possible intellectual discussion with these people. You know, it's just cliches, it's just ideological, etc. So at least in Europe, you're going to have debates, at least the Asians as well. The other day, for instance, it's fantastic. I was looking at the Chinese ambassador in the U.S., Kui Tiankai, which is a very, very well-prepared guy. He was basically explaining why there is no Thucydides trap. Basically, he was saying that Graham Allison is an idiot, which he is, by the way, because you cannot adapt a situation of Athens in 2,500 years ago and extrapolate and compare to the situation between the U.S. And China in the 21st. Not to mention that he had never read the best essays about Thucydides, which were written by Italians in Italian. So, you know, and obviously Kui Tiankai, he knows about that. So, you know,
well, Pepe,
and this passes for American intellectuals.
Well, Pepe, here's what I intended to pursue, and you've set us up for part of it.
Okay.
And for me, it starts with the emotional and illogical imposition of tariffs on trade with China by Trump. And despite the impact of the pandemic, no one even considers a reset to the status quo ante and just say, okay, you know, we made our point and we've got to return to some sort of regular order if the U.S. supply chain is going to be restored and if, you know, we're able to engineer an economic recovery. But he is so ad hoc and, you know, personalizes things. So, you know, for me, the trade war with China is central, but it's also, I think it's important to factor in that Trump violated the fundamentals of war by opening up multiple fronts at the same time, including, you know, putting tariffs on Canada for national security reasons to protect the American dairy industry. So it is so irrational and unsustainable. Yet it, I believe, has led into what you have described as the hybrid war. And I'd like you to take a couple of minutes here because you've written widely about this. And damn it, Pepe, it's hard to keep up with you, okay? You are publishing so much in so many places, and I'm sure I've missed a few pieces. But please take the podium here and explain the hybrid warfare that you see even before we got into the coronavirus 19.
Absolutely. And depending this ties in directly with the whole coronavirus matrix. We still don't know. No, nobody knows for sure the origin of SARS-CoV-2, which provokes COVID-19. If it was a lab thing in Fort Detrick, if it was a lab thing at the Wuhan lab, if it escaped by accident from one of these two labs or even another lab. If it escaped a few years ago and not in November or December of 2019, as the name COVID-19 tells us.
Right.
So nobody knows anything. I've been reading anything that I can get my hands on, and scientific reports, you know, scientists against science. It's you remember the famous spy versus spy cartoon, huh?
Of course.
When we were growing up. Now it's scientist against scientist and virologist against virologist,
yeah.
You know, everyone in black and white. So, and we are caught in a scientific fog about all that. But one of the possibilities, of course, is, and I wrote about this along with many other good analysts out there. We talk to each other, a lot of us. One of our working hypotheses is that this is part of the U.S. hybrid war against China. If we follow the, once again, working hypothesis that this some sort of way came from an American lab and was released intentionally or unintentionally in Wuhan with the objective of provoking the collapse of the Chinese economy, which is a scenario that you have to study because it's a very plausible scenario.
Indeed.
This fits right into the whole myriad level hybrid war, which is a trade war, which is an intimidation war, which is a provocation war in the South China Sea, especially, which is a demonization war in terms of a constant 24/7 American campaign demonizing everything, not only Xi Jinping as another Hitler, but China as a whole, Chinese, the Chinese lie, etc. And this comes from the CIA, from the State Department, from the White House, from the people advising the White House, etc. And the most important thing, what does the other side think? And that's very interesting. And this is something that not many people in the U.S. are aware of. We know about it because of our connections, because, for instance, our China editor is based in Shenzhen. He worked inside the Chinese system. He has very good contacts with Politburo. And he tells us the inside stories about the Politburo. And the most important thing to retain is that the leadership nowadays, they don't care what the Americans are yelling about anymore. They, in their minds, they already made up their minds. We are under a full spectrum attack. You won't read that explicitly in the People's Daily, in the Global Times, etc. You read it in opinion pieces. When they want to send this message in English to an international audience, it's an op-ed. Sometimes it's signed with a pseudonym. Sometimes it's not signed at all. But you can actually see it. We are under full spectrum attack, and we're going to react accordingly. And when Xi Jinping, very important, I wrote about this in one of my columns probably last month, in March. If you analyze the language of how Xi Jinping declared the famous People's War against coronavirus, he said more or less explicitly, translating from Mandarin, we are under attack. This is a war. So they knew from the start something that obviously we in the West don't know. But they had enough time to look. These are too many coincidences. The flu campaigns before, the attack on our poultry industry, etc. All these coincidences with the Wuhan military games. Why Wuhan? Why Wuhan just before the Chinese New Year's Eve? You name it. So in their minds, they already made up their minds. So they are, and you have seen that, especially these past few weeks, they are becoming more vocal. They are defending the Chinese position diplomatically much more vocally than before. They are not the old style reactive Chinese diplomacy. that changed completely. Sometimes those briefings in Beijing, in the Ministry of Foreign Relations, they are very, very hardcore. They are in Mandarin, that's the thing, so it's lost in translation. But when you read the translation, it's really, really hardcore. They are practically accusing the U.S. of, exactly, once again, full spectrum war against the Chinese nation and the Chinese people. And the most important thing after that is they are not going to deviate from the master plan. The master plan is still the New Silk Road, Eurasia integration, Russia-China strategic partnership, expand the Silk Roads through all those corridors in Asia, overland, maritime Silk Road, those ports in the Indian Ocean, the connections in Latin America, even more expansion in Africa. Now they have to calibrate because now they have to concentrate on the domestic economy. So they're going to be there. They're going to have their quantitative easing style program for the domestic Chinese economy. But this will also be interlinked with maintaining all those new Silk Roads projects, especially across Asia and especially in relation to Europe as well. That's why the soft power operation that they have been engaged in these past few weeks, especially with Italy, with the Brits as well, and sending masks and equipment everywhere, this is part of it. This Eastern Europe, this is part of it. So the master plan and the mega strategy still in place, no matter what the Americans throw at them.
Pepe, let me jump in for a moment because what you've just described, it frames a question for me, and that is that Trump, with his enunciation of America First, has signaled a withdrawal by the United States in various ways. And as you know, I think that scaling back our military bases worldwide, our expansionism and imperialism, particularly in the Middle East, is a very wise course. But that's not what's happening. Instead, we are withdrawing and, Trump just repeatedly signals, for example, by stealing medical supplies that were on a plane in Bangkok, loaded for Germany, bought and paid for with Deutschmarks. And we still don't know who the thugs were, but they came in with bags full of cash and they diverted that whole plane load onto a U.S. cargo plane and stole it. And this kind of behavior, not just, threatening through tweets and trying to start a war with Iran right up to today, but the withdrawal of soft power, the withdrawal from diplomatic efforts is something that China is taking huge advantage of. We've created this opening. And, China's not in significant ways expanding its military footprint or even its military budget. And they are using capitalist tactics to basically exponentially expand their sphere of influence.
Absolutely. They're beating a capitalist in their own game.
Yeah.
And this is Sun Tzu applied. And they're very good at doing that. Very, very good. There's a wonderful book that came out this week. In fact, it's my article today on Asia Times. It's an essay about the book. It's not a review. It's an essay about the book. It's extremely interesting by Kishore Mahbubani. It's called Has China Won? Kishore Mahbubani is a very interesting character. He's very well regarded in the U.S. in foreign policy circles because he was a former Singapore diplomat, but he's a former president of the U.N. Security Council as well. Mm-hmm. Singaporean ambassador at the U.N. He's the dean of the Lee Kuan Yew School of Geopolitics and Political Science in Singapore. And he publishes almost every year, he publishes a book basically trying to explain to Americans what is all about China. And this book is wonderful. It's very well documented. He's very patient. I admire his diplomatic patience to explain the basic facts for anyone in Asia or Asians or people who deal with China, no. But obviously, they are not. You are not going to read in the New York Times, Washington Post, etc. And one of the things that he says is it's fantastic. When you look at the Chinese Communist Party, the official designation, the whole thing is about Chinese. It's not about communist. And this is fantastic because he tries to explain. For them, the most important thing is what Xi Jinping announced in terms of the rejuvenation of the Chinese nation, or the fact that he wants to turn the country into a mid-level country with a very acceptable standard of living in the next 2 decades max, industrialize it, eliminate hunger, and turn it into an economic superpower, which it already is, etc. And there's nothing in this master plan which you can read in terms of military expansionism. Absolutely nothing. The only thing is, okay, the key question is Taiwan, which for the leadership in Beijing, it was part of China and has to be part of China. That's extremely debatable. The Japanese can say that Taiwan is Japanese as well. So that's another story. But it's not that they are privileged, for instance, taking Taiwan by force. No, it's still Deng Xiaoping. One country, two systems. And in the case of Taiwan, one country, three systems, mm-hmm. right? And the South China Sea, which the Chinese consider correctly, I would say, their sphere of influence. If they should take over 90% of the South China Sea, that's also extremely debatable. I particularly think it's wrong, but this is something that should be debated between the littoral states in the South China Sea and Beijing, which is something that they are little by little, slowly but surely doing, and the situation is improving. There is nothing about the Chinese want to conquer Eurasia militarily, or that they want to invade parts of Eurasia, or, you know, nothing. It's not a militaristic power. And their whole national defense policy is defense, is not offense, because they know that they are encircled by American bases and American forces. They know about the island chains very, very well. They want to have full, as a big power, margin of maneuver in the Western Pacific. That's absolutely normal for a big power, an emerging big power, and soon the number one power. So the good thing about Mabubani's book is that he explained this in detail to an American audience. This was a book that he wrote especially for an American. It's not even global, for an American audience specifically. So I wonder how it's going to be received in the U.S. Probably dismissed.
Well, I will look for it. I'll look for it, Pepe. It sounds fascinating.
Definitely. It's a must read for anyone dealing with foreign policy in the U.S. But I can imagine some people like Peter Navarro, or reading this book, and obviously he will not understand a thing. Or he will say, no, this is basically CCP propaganda, which, by the way, some of the first reviewers already said it is CCP propaganda. So it's even impossible to start a dialogue.
So
as you were saying before.
Let me go ahead and complete your thought. I want to turn in a slightly different direction.
Like I said before, the Chinese are not going to deviate from the big picture. They have number one priority, put their economic house in order, which they think they're going to do starting now, 2020, and by the end of 2021, things will be more or less back to normal. Number two, continue the expansion of the new Silk Roads side by side with the internationalization of the yuan, etc. And number three, Made in China 2025, it's only 4.5 years from now. It's literally tomorrow. And they are not going to deviate from this process of basically digitalizing most of their economy and getting to the next level in information technology. So, you know, the major planks of the master plan are still there. Let's say they were derailed for a while because of coronavirus, But if the other side was thinking in terms of this is going to completely collapse the Chinese economy, intentionally or unintentionally, we can already say for sure the plan failed.
And Pepe, you frequently cite the growing alliance between Russia and China. And I'll note that both Putin and Xi have cemented control for the foreseeable future, and in fact, for their lifetimes. And that will provide, I think, a kind of continuity that we are unable to ever achieve in our structure here in the United States. But I want to turn to a kind of different angle, because one of the myths of Reaganism is that our nearly doubling of the defense budget during the Reagan administration is what brought down the Soviet Union. And I call it a complete myth because we now know that the Soviet Union was imploding all on its own, and Gorbachev was the one who recognized that and really tried to deal with it. But I think that we're actually experiencing, in the decline of the American empire, the real version of this, that we continue to increase our so-called defense budget, the War Department, at our own peril. And when you couple that with the Trump tax cuts that, you know, nobody's allowed to even discuss repealing them, even at a time when we're borrowing heavily and the deficit hawks are flying again, we are really imploding by spending so much on a military, you know, renewed investments in nuclear weapons. And so I see that the Reagan myth is actually playing out as a plausible scenario of the sharp decline of the American empire. And I'd like your comment.
Oh, yes, absolutely, Peter. And this reminds me of what Immanuel Todd was already writing about in 2002, if I remember well. Todd is one of the best historians, geographers, anthropologists in France. He's one of the best European intellectuals, old school, multidisciplinarian, etc. I think some of his books are translated in the US. And he wrote this book, Après l'Empire, After the Empire, in 2002, where he was saying basically what you're saying, that the American empire would risk doing the same thing that happened with the USSR. And it's true, because now we have an overextended military power that is not even the number one military power in the world anymore, because with the new hypersonic weapons and the new missiles, Russia is, I heard from different people, two or three generations ahead of the Americans. They are not the number one economic power anymore, or they won't be soon. By PPP, they're already number two. And in overall terms, they could be overtaken in the next few years. They are imploding from the inside, because you have the 1%, then the 5% who have more or less something. The upper middle class in the U.S., and then you have this enormous base of sub-employed, unemployed, marginally employed, informal economy, the aggregation of all modern ills that you can imagine, imploding from the inside, in a state of practical civil war, with a polarized discourse between extreme right and, I cannot even say center, let's say... how can you describe the Democrats nowadays?
It's the number two oligarch / corporate party.
Yes, excellent. That's a perfect definition. That's it. So so the only thing missing, and we don't even need them anymore, is the Visigoths invading, the barbarians invading. You don't need a barbarian invasion, because the barbarians are already at home. So it is an internal implosion, in fact. So it is imploding in different ways compared to the Soviet Union, but the process is already there. There's no what you said is absolutely correct.
So Pepe, one of your recent columns that was picked up at Consortium News was a little fuzzy for me, and I have to concede I read it hurriedly. But you talked about Confucius and the whole different zeitgeist of the Chinese people in the face of the pandemic and the concomitant economic rollback. So take a minute to explain that, please.
Yeah, exactly. It was not only it's a pity because my original title was Confucius, Buddha, and Lao Tzu. It's important because these are the three main philosophical strands, not only for China, but for many parts of East Asia. Don't forget that Buddhism is extremely important in not only in India, but in Southeast Asia, in Japan, and still in China. There are at least 100 million Buddhists in China. I visit Buddhist temples when I went to North Korea, for instance. So this is very important, these three. And the last part of the column, I talk about how ingrained this is in the collective unconscious of East Asians, the traditions from Confucius, from the Tao, and from Buddhism. And this gives them cultural solidity in terms of compassion, in terms of understanding that everything changes, in terms of respecting authority, but respecting the other, which is something that the American elites will never understand what it means. And when you compare these values with Western haughtiness or the complete hysteria responding to COVID-19, I wanted to make this deep contrast to explain why there was a success in relatively short term, not only in China, not only in Wuhan, but in Japan, in Singapore, in Taiwan, in Hong Kong as well. So this is very, very important. But if you don't understand Asian culture and philosophy, which is something that Western elites, with very, very few exceptions, don't, you cannot even know how to address them. And if you don't respect their traditions, and if you don't respect this accumulated knowledge, it's absolutely impossible. On the other hand, some of the best and the brightest in Asia, they studied in Western universities, and they incorporated everything that they could from Plato, from Aristotle, from Kant, from Hegel, from not to mention from Marx, of course. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it's a one-way traffic. It's a one-way traffic. You find, of course, in Europe is different, or in Russia, you find absolutely brilliant Italian, German, Russian scholars that go very, very deep into all these trends, you know, Confucianism, Taoism, Buddhism, the imperial tradition in China. They try to understand the concept of the mandate of heaven. For instance, why the Chinese Communist Party is still in power? Because for the majority of the Chinese population, they are incarnating very well the mandate of heaven. They are trying to ameliorate the situation of the general population. The day that the majority starts thinking, no, this is a bunch of crooks, they will be ejected from power. There's absolutely no question about that. And that's why they are so... They do freak out, the Politburo, the leadership in Beijing. They know that following the Deng Xiaoping dictates to get rich is glorious, and you know, and then we're going to have socialism with Chinese characteristics, and we're going to be a relatively wealthy middle class country. This is also important, but it's also important the way the government has to deliver this to the average Chinese. And the way they responded to COVID-19, which initially was a mess, there's no question, because this was a regional problem. It had not gotten to the position where there was a report on Xi Jinping's desk or one of the Politburo top seven, you know. The moment that this thing arrived at the leadership, they immediately took over and they launched the so-called People's War, which was extremely successful. So this is the problem of a hierarchical system like in China. They need to have this concept of we are responsible all the time, and the mandate of heaven is in jeopardy if we do anything stupid. They have to explain this to the party chief in Hubei province, you know, from the small functionaries that take care of public health in a faraway province. That's the problem with the system. The main tenets of the system are very, very sound, and they are based in ancient Chinese culture. And that's why it works. You know.
Now, Pepe, this is fascinating, and I would just return the comments you made from a American exceptionalist and reductionist point of view. And that is that all the things that you described are treated as authoritarian. And yes. That, you know, people submit and we accentuate reports from those who do not and try to make heroes out of whistleblowers and, you know, people, the doctor in Wuhan, he was an optometrist, but he's trying to, you know, send up a flare that there's a real problem here. And so the simple reduction in American thinking is that, you know, this is just a brutal authoritarian government. And because they have a communist system, that's really all we need to know to demonize them and dismiss them.
You're right, because everything is it's extremely reductionist, because there's no intellectual debate behind. There's no interest in even having an intellectual discussion or a debate. Everything is literally reduced to a slogan. Ah, this is a bunch of communists. This is a bunch of authoritarians. It's a dictator, etc. And this applies to anybody. Saddam Hussein, Arafat, Gaddafi, Xi Jinping, Erdogan, the mullahs in Iran, Putin, etc. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. So it's and as I told you, I always try to make an effort to listen to the so-called intellectuals, or at least what passes for intelligentsia. And then I come up with these pieces in a foreign policy magazine or foreign affairs and all that, and you despair completely. Because even if it's well-phrased, even if it's the wonderful references that they throw there, Plato and Aristotle here and there, Gibbon, etc., but they don't know how to think because they are incapable of exchanging with the other. And I always joke with some of my friends, maybe these people, they need a Levi-Strauss virus injection on their bodies, no? So they understand the concept of the other. And how do you have to relate to the other and talk to the other, understand the other, and listen to the other, especially. Typical examples like we cannot negotiate with Iran. Obviously, you don't even make the effort to get together with them and listen, which is something that at least the Obama administration did. I was at some of those meetings. And could you actually see Kerry and Zarif actually discussing substance? And this is how you do it diplomatically. And this is how you get a deal. I'm not defending anybody. I'm just giving you an example of how diplomacy works. Mm-hmm. Try this with Mike Pompeo. We lie, we cheat, we steal.
So, Pepe, what is your view of what's going on in your native country? Because we saw this scene of Bolsonaro acting out in the way Trump would like to get down with the rabble and these orchestrated mini-mobs, as I call them, that are then depicted on television as a meaningful uprising of the victimized white male here in the United States. But Bolsonaro, who coughed his way through a recent rally in Brasilia,
Literally, yeah.
Yes. you know, and may have been infected at Mar-a-Lago. That's still a little bit unclear. His son said so and then walked it back on Fox News, so you can't believe any of that shit. What is your view of his route to dictatorship? Because as it's played in the American media, he seems to revere the military dictatorship of, 18 years that ended in the mid-80s. And there are a lot of fears of the path that he is on.
Oh, in fact, I have breaking news for you and for everybody. I was talking to the Brazilians before I start talking to you, Peter. I was doing a podcast with them. And in the middle of the podcast, they were telling me that, in fact, two mega breaking news.
Okay,
today,
go.
Happening as we speak. One of them is that Justice Minister Sergio Moro quit the government.
Oh.
This is huge because this is the deep state guy.
Yeah.
The main articulator of the whole car wash operation, the whole thing that had two objectives. One, impeach Dilma.
Yeah.
And two, put Lula in jail. The whole articulation was through Sergio Moro, who then became Justice Minister for Bolsonaro. So Bolsonaro's so-called popular appeal, to a great extent, was due to Moro. Moro entertained dreams of running for president, or he's still entertaining dreams of running for president next time as well. So the fact that he's jumping off the Titanic at the moment is very, very meaningful, because this means many things. One, that he already has a promise that he's going to have a role to play in the next presidential elections. Two, he's jumping the ship because he sees that the whole thing is floundering and Bolsonaro's days may be a matter of days or weeks, or maximum months, and then I'll explain that as well. And number three, maybe the U.S. deep state, his connections in Langley, etc., told him, look, maybe you should start considering a new career. All these are very, very plausible explanations. The second part of the equations is even more interesting. I don't know if you in the U.S. know, probably not, but for, I would say, at least for the past 2 weeks, Brazil is being run by a different operational president.
Really?
It's not Bolsonaro. It's a general called Braga Neto. Braga Neto was the chief of staff of Bolsonaro. So they had this absolutely extraordinary meeting in Brasilia. Bolsonaro, Mourão, the vice president, four-star general, and the big, big guys, all the generals that are part of the Brazilian equivalent of the National Security Council, which is called, translating loosely, Cabinet of Institutional Security, GSI, the acronym in Portuguese. So these guys, they sat at the same table and said, okay, what next? Okay, you stay as president, but everything that you're saying about coronavirus, etc., is bullshit. Nobody's going to listen to you, including starting with us. So the guy who's going to take the decisions, the major decisions now, is going to be him, chief of staff, Braga Neto. So obviously you won't read this in the Brazilian equivalents of the New York Times, the papers in São Paulo, which I used to write for in a previous incarnation, or in the global network, the Brazilian equivalent of the three networks in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, what we discuss among us is that this is a sort of white coup that does not walk like a white coup and cannot be identified as a white coup. Otherwise, you're going to have the Bolsonaro gangs in the streets against the military, of course. But this is an arrangement among the military to have a sort of transition, taking power away from Bolsonaro, which they can see more than anybody, is completely isolated, especially by the way he completely ignored the coronavirus crisis. And they can have a slow transition via Braga Neto, the operational president at the moment, to the point where they can have Mourão, the vice president, actually becoming president, and they find a solution to get Bolsonaro sidelined along with the family. The clan is very important. So that would mean some sort of legal arrangement preventing that they are going to be pursued, brought to justice, in fact, right, because it's a criminal gang. And then we can go on forever about their crimes. The thing is, so the main, where we stand at the moment, how Bolsonaro is going to accept this deal, assuming he accepts it, if there's no prosecution involved, is some sort of golden parachute, etc., he might even accept it. He already confessed on the record that governing is too complicated for him, and obviously he's not equipped to manage a high school. Can you imagine a country as complex as Brazil? Né? So the thing is, so how are the military going to deal with Bolsonaro's popular support? So then comes what's going to happen, I think, in the next few hours in Brazil today. Apparently, Finance Minister Paulo Guedes, disciple of Milton Friedman, ultra-neoliberal, a Pinochetist, as they call him in Brazil, probably is going to abandon ship as well. Hmm. So then he's going to lose his main economic support, which was the link between Bolsonaro and Brazilian big money, Brazilian corporations, lobbies, etc., and his support with the masses, which was Moro. If these two things happen, one already happened, Moro out. If Guedes is out, second part of this equation, then I would say the military have the perfect environment to organize the real white coup. Let's say we have a pre-white coup before, then we're going to have the real white coup. So this is where we stand at the moment. It's a very, very interesting political juncture. But overall, it's arguably we can say that Bolsonaro's days are probably over in a matter, as I said, of probably weeks, maximum a few months.
Wow.
And this is something that the majority of the Brazilian population actually wants. So the problem is how to contain this. I was asking them a few hours ago, what about his support? They say, look, before the whole thing was 36%, which is huge. With Moro out, and if Guedes is out, it's probably go down to 20 or even less. So if the military are sure that Bolsonaro's support is marginal, then no problem. You know, the scenario is in place.
Okay, we heard it here first, Pepe. Thank you for that.
You heard it here first.
I had no idea.
Knows everything about it.
I had no idea where it was going when I asked you the question. one more thing, my friend. One of my listeners, Edward Lowe, yes, asked me to ask you a question, and he has attempted to reach out to you on Facebook. He writes, I tried to send him a suggestion that you, Pepe, should try to organize a documentary of the BBC David Attenborough National Geographic sort that would travel the new Silk Road. It would not just display the scenery and history. It would be a foil to explain the geopolitics and economics in the face of all the disinformation by the United States. And he gallantly volunteers to be the naive traveler to hang the story on. Are you ready?
Wow.
Are you ready for that?
Look, I talked about this already. There is a German filmmaker who is already engaged in a similar project. He contacted me to be one of his advisors, or he's going to interview me as well. He asked me for suggestions, etc. The problem is I would love to do it myself, but you need a solid sponsor behind it. This is not something that you can do just with crowdfunding. Mm-hmm. I would like to do it as a mega production value thing, you know, and this is expensive. It's you can say a few million dollars to do it properly. But I would know how to do it. I will know exactly where to go, who to talk to, and the itinerary, of course. So let's say this is an idea for a project that it's on hold at the moment.
Well, I'll just mention
that it has to be done. It has to be done.
Ai Weiwei has managed to get funding for some of his feature films. And I don't know if there's any possible alliance. I don't know his view of the Silk Road scenario.
Yes.
But I just mention it.
I can always talk to Oliver Stone. Mm-hmm. I can ask him production instructions.
Okay.
Who should I talk to get funding for this project? You know.
Well, we'll leave it there, and we'll do lunch, and try to get that on track. Okay, Pepe.
Wonderful, fantastic, Peter, fantastic.
Well, thank you for an excellent conversation. It's always so interesting and informative. And today, you even brought us breaking news from Brazil.
Thank you, Peter. Always an enormous pleasure to talk to you. You know how fond I am of California, of San Francisco particularly. So,
well, come on back. I've got a bottle of wine ready for you.
Ah, no. I want bleach with bourbon.
Thank you, Pepe. Good night.
Okay, my friend. Thank you. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks for listening to this in-depth, comprehensive, and somewhat mind-blowing conversation with Pepe Escobar. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until